The following session is from the 2016 NCHE Thrive Homeschool Conference. For additional recordings, visit nche.com.
My name is Kristen Eckenweiler. Have I met any of you before? Because this is my home conference, and I love doing this conference. So a lot of times I can remember your faces, and you'll be shocked, because I do this all conference season long. Other than this year, I didn't. I took the month of May off because I have a graduate this year. I am a homeschool mom. I've been homeschooling now for 13 years. I have two boys, one that just graduated, and I have a rising seventh grader. And for those of you with little people, you blink your eyes and they're walking across the stage. I'm serious. You just blink your eyes. It happens that fast. And so I took the month of May off, so my head was nowhere else but where he was, and in that moment for us, it was a beautiful thing. I come from Wilson, North Carolina. Does anybody know where Wilson is? Yay! So it's not too far. It's just outside of Raleigh, about 35, 40 miles east. And so this is home away from home for me. This is one of the closest conferences that I get to do. This is, believe it or not, my 10th year speaking at NCHE. 10 years! That's crazy! It's crazy because I'm just not getting any older, but the conference keeps going. Okay, that's not true. We're going to be talking about multisensory teaching, and it really is a game changer. And so I'm glad you're here, because I think this will drive just about everybody that you want to hear or any curriculum that you want to see this weekend. And I hope that it will change your thinking about the way we teach. Mostly, this has been catered to an audience of people who have children who have learning struggles of one kind or another. And yet the research says that everybody learns best by multisensory teaching. And so, so we've started to gear things back before we started doing inclusive classrooms where we had to teach groups of kids where we don't do it so well anymore. And so now we're starting to teach better and not more. Does that make sense? We want to teach better and not more. So everybody has a handout, so that's just a place for you to scratch down what you hear me say that's interesting that you want to remember, or you know where you want to go for dinner, whatever works. So I'm doing a new thing this time. I'm doing this on my iPad, and it's really cool. So I can't see my screen. So let's talk about what we mean by multisensory. First of all, creepy picture, yes. But you're liable to remember what I mean by multisensory by that creepy picture, right? So multisensory, ooh, I'm really loud now. Okay. I'm going to take your word for it. All I know is that the people next door are going to write notes on multisensory teaching. All right, so we have visual, which is what we see, what we take in by sight. We have auditory, which is what we hear. We have tactile, that is touch. Tactile is touch. And kinesthetic is movement. Rarely will you ever have a tactile lesson that's not a kinesthetic lesson, or a kinesthetic lesson that's not a tactile lesson. I'm going to unpackage all of those for you. To be multisensory, you're talking about two or more of those modalities happening. A modality is a way that we learn. So many of you in this room may think that you're, I don't know, a visual learner. Or you might, I'm a very auditory learner, And we live in a very auditory world, by the way. And everybody would say, oh, I'm a kinesthetic learner, which involves movement, and that's great. Everybody's a kinesthetic learner. Everybody is. If I throw you down in the sand, you'll remember that motion, and you'll remember what it felt like, right? And so being active in something is absolutely the way that we learn best. So kinesthetic is movement, tactile is touch. Now I want to talk to you just for a moment about smell and about taste. These two senses have great research happening right now on how, it's amazing to me that it's happening now, because if you think about it, many of us could smell something and it would take us back somewhere. Like that smell ingrained a memory for you. And so they're doing a lot of research on children who have trouble focusing and then different smells that help help them concentrate. Do I have any essential oil people in the room? You know I do. We're at a homeschool conference, right? That's where we go. Like if you go down in the vendor hall, it smells like eucalyptus down there. It's just like, wow, they're here. And so think about these essential oils. I just read a really great piece of literature that talked about smells and concentration. And all of the smells associated with concentration in different oils for calming and focus are trees, tree smells. They all involve those. And where do we have trees? We have them outside. And so there's all this research that talks about how kids that have trouble focusing do better outside, where they can smell the outside, basically take the roof off, where they're not indoors. They do better. And I know I have one at home that does much better outside than he does inside. He would live in a world with no roof and no ceiling, and he would do well. And so that's very interesting. So some of the research says that you can burn or use diffusers to have certain smells that help move things from short-term memory into long-term memory. Now, you're welcome to look at all this research yourself. This is very interesting to me that these smells that we know are very powerful. Like, oh, wow, that reminds me of Grandma's kitchen in 1972. Some of you weren't born yet, but you know what I mean? You all have a smell, and smells are powerful. They can clear a room. You know, so, some people are overwhelmed by perfumes and things like that, but smells are very mind-orientated, so they help move things into memory. You might remember, I don't like that place because it's overpowering and its smell of XYZ. We all know what it smells like at the movie theater, so we think popcorn, movie theater, that kind of thing. We associate things with smells. And it's the same thing with taste. Now, when you think about when we do unit studies, many times we'll throw in a cooking project. Now, cooking is going to come up in this discussion because cooking involves many, many sensories when we learn. We could teach math. We can teach all kinds of things with cooking. One of them is taste. And so when you do unit studies, especially in, let's say, history or just learning different cultures, if you throw in taste, you will associate cumin with South America, maybe. And so these different tastes are now being studied as another means of moving things from short-term memory into long-term memory. So smell and taste are really up and coming as part of the way that we learn. Another sense, another way that we learn. So I just wanted to throw those in there for fun. Now, like I said when I opened, it used to be that they would say that multisensory teaching was the best way to teach children who had a learning disability of some sort. And they show here basically the flow of learning. When we talk about the flow of learning, we talk about active areas of the brain. And there is a path to learning, and this is like a lot of $10 words, but it's really simple. When we learn something and we get it into long-term memory, the brain MRI will light up, boom, doom, doom, and it's very interesting. Now, I do a workshop, I'm not doing it here, on teaching the learning disabled child, but I think it's most fascinating that in reality, kids who struggle with learning, if we teach them in a multisensory way, different parts of the brain light up. So it's not a natural path, it's not a straight path, but the brain is compensating for areas that are deficit. And some people think that that's an imbalance. I think it's a miracle. I think it's a miracle that our brains light up and do things that quote-unquote normal people in their brains in their straight path. By the way, normal is only a selection on your washing machine. That's a quote from Naomi Judd. I've never had an original thought in my life, but I liked it, so I used it. So we talk about here speed and path of learning and all of that, and the research says the more modalities that I can use, the easier that path is. It's almost like if I said to my child, I need you to go upstairs and get the box. Okay? So upstairs could be vast. There could be many boxes. The directions are not real clear. But if I said, I need you to go upstairs to the yellow room on your right and get the box that's wrapped in purple paper, it's about as big as a shoebox, and bring it to me right now. I've opened that path. See, I've given them more opportunity to do the right thing, to grab the right box. Does that make sense? So we're talking about this flow of learning and how multimodalities help them not only understand new information when it's given, but to remember it. Because for many of us in this room, our kids can do the, yeah, got it. Right? And then tomorrow, it might not even be tomorrow, it could be 5 minutes later. It's like you've never said it. Right? And so that's challenging for some kids. Not only they receive this new information, but it doesn't go from short-term into long-term memory. And so we're talking about different ways of learning that help to move it into long-term memory. Now, this is just a cute little cartoon. I'm only seeing sideways here, but this is the little creepy guy that lives in your brain, and he digs out files. Now, For some of our children, they are delayed learners, or they might just need a little bit more time when learning new information. That is not necessarily a learning disability. It's just a delay. And so it just means when I say, when I introduce the word horizon, and they are aware of what the sun is, what the ocean is, what the sun and the mountains are, but as they try to make that connection with the new word horizon, they pull the wrong file. That little man runs and he gets the wrong file. And so he brings it back, and you're like, where did that come from? Any of your kids ever say things and you wonder, where did that come from? Yeah, they pulled the wrong file. They just pulled the wrong file. And so we send them back to get the new file. Or, again, when we teach from this multimodality way, we give them more opportunities to get the correct file the first time. And I'm just going to give you one more cartoon, and then everyone will understand what I'm talking about. Now, here's the other creepy guy that lives in your brain. And he connects things. He connects things. And that schema, that's just a big letter word for things that you know. Things that you know. Now, using my example about the horizon, let's just think about things that you know. Now, my child understands what the sun is. He understands what the sea is. So then I bring those things into his mind visually, kinesthetically, whether I draw a horizon, color horizon, talk about it, show him pictures of it, whatever I'm doing, he's connecting the new information to the old information. And so many times wires get crossed and they just connect it wrong. And it makes perfect sense to you because guess what? Your schema is much bigger than theirs is. What you bring to the table is vast. You've read more than they have. You've been more places than they have. You've been through school. You understand more. You've visited more places. You've been through history. You understand so much more. And we take for granted that they're going to understand as we say this new information and connect it to schema that they don't have, but you do. And so we have to keep in mind that we need to continually give them things to make connections to that they already know. Does that make sense? Everybody do the bobblehead. Good. Nobody's sleepy yet. Some of you just ate lunch. I'm losing some of you. We could do calisthenics. Usually it's so cold in here I don't lose anybody, but it's not cold to me this time. See, she's fanning herself, but she's got a sweater on, so I think we've got a schizophrenic crowd. I'm not sure what's happening. All right, let's talk about visual. Now, I just want you to know that my husband and I are both reading specialists, by the way. I didn't finish introducing myself. We're both reading specialists. We work with kids who have learning challenges all the time, and this is my heart and soul and ministry. It's my ministry. I love to talk to moms because I'm a homeschool mom. I love to talk to dads because my husband's a homeschool dad. And I believe it's a Maya Angelou quote, and she's from Winston-Salem. And she said, when we know better, we do better. She actually said it better than that, but when you have the information, nobody cares more about your child's learning than you do. Nobody. And so I love to bring information to homeschool parents. And so my husband and I are reading specialists. We were in the public school system. I taught at the collegiate level. So did he. And then we decided to homeschool our own children. He actually did his doctorate on homeschooling back when everybody was swimming upstream. And so my biggest accomplishment year to date is standing at the door. That is my son. He's a recent homeschool graduate all the way through. And so we decided to come home and homeschool, and then there was this vast and hollow, great big need in the homeschool community to get this information to parents, because a lot of my colleagues would say, this is too much for you to understand. This is for us to do, the specialists to do. And I say, pooey on that. That's not true, because I know you. I know my homeschool community, and so when you know it, you do it, right? So that's what we do. And so my husband does all the behind-the-scenes work, so he's responsible for the creepy pictures that you see on the slides that he lets me get up here and put up on the screen. So that is Mr. Bean in a diaper, and I don't know why, other than the big eyes will make you remember visual, right? So let's just look at the little boy with the big brown eyes, because he's cute, not creepy. So when we talk about visual, of course, we're going to talk about things that we see, and I'm going to put up some examples of what I mean by visual. And demonstrations is one of them. Demonstrations. And so that's not just, that's not hands-on really, but it could be a science demonstration. It could be you go to the zoo and you see how they feed them, you see how they change their horseshoes, whatever. It's a demonstration. And so seeing that visually, that's the type of visual. TV and videos. I'm going to throw these up here, and then we'll talk about some of them. This is a PowerPoint or a keynote, and this is a visual. If I were just talking to you, which in years gone by, that's how we did it, that would just be auditory. So this is a visual element to what you're doing now. You're seeing these things come up on the slide. TV and videos are more powerful than ever before in the world. Computers are more powerful than ever before in the world. You can go on your TV now and do a search for what you're studying in school. And you can record it based on, it might come on at 3 o'clock in the morning. Maybe it's on Gettysburg. Maybe it's on Hiroshima. My son says I say that wrong. Hiroshima. And so so whatever it is, this is letting you go outside not just of your own home, but of the world and the connections that you have locally. So you can watch an eagle's nest and waste all the hours in your day waiting for it to do something interesting. But it's mesmerizing. Has anybody ever done that? They have these, yeah, right? It's like, it's addictive. And so they have cameras on these eagle nests, and you'll see an egg, and then you won't leave for 36 days because you're waiting for something to happen. But you can watch remote areas. You can watch missionaries in foreign lands. I mean, what you're able to do and see nowadays in your own classroom, in your home, is beyond the human imagination. It's the stuff that the Jetsons was made of when we were kids, right? And so even I've been in doctor's offices where moms are showing them a video on their phone, you know, on whatever. And so, I mean, this visual way of learning has been opened tremendously just by advances in technology. Graphics are pictures, and pictures are worth 1,000 words. Graphics and pictures are huge, huge. And let me, come on. There it is, pictures. So when we talk about visual, that's pretty common. That's what we see. It's what we see. So seeing something is one modality of learning. So remember, to have a multimodality lesson, it needs to be more than one. So let's add in another one. Let's talk about auditory. Auditory. Before I leave visual, let me just caution you that many of the vendors are now jumping on this bandwagon because it's such a profound way to teach. And so I actually saw a vendor that had a new video out that was of their instructor teaching the material. So it would be just watching me on video. That is not visual. Okay? Watching a person is not visual. It's still auditory. You're just listening. So be careful if they say it's multimodality. We've added a new visual, and it's just a person speaking. Because that's auditory only. It's not visual. They're not showing you any demonstrations. They're not doing any experiments. They're not showing you pictures or graphs or drawing. They're not doing anything interesting but speaking to you. And speaking can be interesting, but it's still just auditory. All right, let's talk about auditory. What do we mean by auditory? Music, recordings, and the last one are lectures. This is a lecture setting. Now, this is the way that many, many people take in information. I said that I was a very auditory person. Many of you might be auditory people. But here's the kicker. I'm just going to give you a little aside. It'll be worth the price of admission. The word dyslexia does not just mean transposing letters. That is not the definition of dyslexia. Dyslexia is a neuropath thing. It's happening in the brain. It's neurological in its origin. And so children have types of dyslexia that are auditory. Some of you may even know your child has an auditory processing challenge or a deficit in the phonological component of language. A phoneme is a unit of sound. And so they can hear you just fine. It doesn't show up on a hearing test. It's happening in the brain. And so you might have someone who's laboring when you do something auditorily because they're not processing that on their own. It's a challenge. It's a type of dyslexia. It's called auditory dyslexia. And so if you're just doing a lot of lecture type or recordings or that type of teaching and your child isn't getting it and you think you got to turn it up, or don't you know, did you hear them just say that type of thing? That could be part of the problem, is that they're not processing it auditorily. Again, it does not show up on a hearing test it is just an auditory processing challenge. So what they hear you say, they go in and they process, they grab the wrong cable or the wrong file continuously. And you're beating your head against the wall because you're like, I just said that. We just did that. And so keep in mind, if it's just auditory, you could be dealing with an auditory challenge. You could be dealing with an auditory challenge. Okay, music has been greatly associated with learning. Greatly. I'm gonna unpackage that just a little bit in a minute. Recordings are great. I know most homeschool families have this down. You get recordings, you listen to a book across town, or you listen to it a whole series driving across country. And so those are recordings. Those are great. Now, as a reading specialist, I can tell you that when kids listen to books, the research says it's just as powerful as if they read it themselves. So for those of you who think it's cheating and you feel like the bad mom of the year, it's not. Put a tape in, let them listen to a book. Now think about it. And I will be doing other workshops on reading. I'll throw that up here at the end. But specifically in reading, there's an area of reading called fluency. And when your kids get to words that they don't know when they're reading, typically they'll skip them, they'll omit them, they'll guess at them, anything like that. And so they're not learning that word. In fact, it puts all kinds of holes in what they're reading, and so their comprehension is off. But it's not a comprehension problem. It's a fluency problem because they're skipping things and omitting things. But that doesn't happen when they're listening to a book. Whoever's reading it is reading it. They're learning the pauses that we make at commas. They're learning the stops that we make. They're learning voice inflection and the difference between a question and a statement. And so all of that is happening, and their vocabulary goes up and up and up because they might not know the word by itself, but when that person uses it in context, they got a new word. And so recordings are great. Great auditory way of learning things. And then the last one is lectures. Most young people and some older people hate that type of learning, hate it. And so lectures, the most common one would be Sunday morning if you go to church. That would be a lecture setting unless you have a pastor that puts up a PowerPoint and puts up notes and interesting. Then they add another element which makes it a multimodality lecture. Otherwise, you're just being spoken to. And the number one way to help learn information in a lecture-only setting is to record what you're hearing so you can go back and listen to it again. Because you will miss 30 to 40% of what's being said while you're trying to take notes or you're trying to listen or whatever. And so I'm a big note taker when it comes to lectures. I just write because I hardly hear what they're saying, but I can go back and look at my notes just because that's helpful if it's just a lecture only. And if you have a monotone, very boring speaker, that's waste of college money right there. That sounds personal, doesn't it? I had one, and it was like, what are you doing? Like, he was a brilliant mind, but to listen to him was painful. All right, so auditory. So let's move on to tactile, which is touch. Tactile, which is touch. So many of you, I know, you've done the sand thing. You taught your kids to read with sandpaper, but really, this type of touch really helps move things from short-term memory into long-term memory. So just touching the sandpaper. One is to put sand in a cookie sheet, shake it out, put saran wrap over it. They can feel, they can trace the letters. You can do that with Cool Whip even, where they can feel the Cool Whip, and you shake it back out so it's even. I always recommend Cool Whip instead of shaving cream. You know, they eat it. It's kind of gross. But we ate paste when we were kids, and we're still around. So this is a way that we do a lot of teaching of learning and letters and words. We use that type of touch. We do a reading camp. Oh, before I forget, we're doing a reading camp this summer in Wilson, North Carolina. That information's at our booth. My son says our booth number sounds like a vending machine. It's G7. I don't know what you get, but that's where we're at. And so if you want any information on reading camp, that's in Wilson, North Carolina. But we do a lot of this tactile, hands-on stuff with kids that are struggling to read. And it doesn't matter. I've seen people do this in chemistry with kids, where they'll have them even use Play-Doh to do out the table, the periodic table. And so just moving things, tactile, touching them helps them remember. Helps them remember. Again, remember, we're giving them a map, a clearer map to what they're where. The information is they're going to store and remember. So the more modalities I give them, the easier it is to remember. And so we have hands-on tactile touch. And it is messy and it is dirty and it's fun for them and we hate it. I hate it. I hate it. It takes time, right? And I just want, I got a list. I got a plan. And how many people in the room, I got a plan, right? And so I wrote it down. We got to do this and we got something else to do. We got something else to do. And so, so we have to do it, but this takes time. But remember, I told you at the onset, this is about quality learning. It's about learning better, not more. And if I'm a firm believer that if we teach our children to love to learn, look, you should repeat after me. I'll never teach them everything. Say it louder like you mean it. I'll never teach them everything. Right? So remember that. So when you walk into your neighbor or your friends and she's teaching something about some foreign war that you hadn't even thought about teaching, or good grief, she's teaching critical thinking and you hadn't thought, I haven't taught her any critical thinking, right? You're never going to teach them everything. But what you should be aiming for is teaching them how they learn and to love to learn. They might not learn like you. So you're going to teach them like you learn. They're not going to love that. So we do this from this multimodality way, so they love it, and they get enriched by it, and they remember things, and they touch it, and they see it, and they explore it, and then they love it. They want to keep doing that long after you're gone, long after the textbooks are closed, long after your plans are over. And so we're lifelong learners. That's what we want to teach them. So hands-on. So when you go and do field trips, we're going to move into kinesthetics, where you're moving, and you're exploring, and you're touching things, they don't forget those lessons. Now, I use this example a lot. Last year, I guess it's been about 2 years now, I was doing a homeschool conference in New York, in Manhattan, of all places. I got to test up there. It was fabulous. And so they took us on this little venture, and we went out on this boat, and we went out to Ellis Island, and we did the Statue of Liberty. And on the boat, there was about, I don't know, 40 kids with lanyards, much like I have on, but it had a picture. It had a picture of someone really that immigrated to our country, a real person. And it told them exactly where they were going to have to go, each station they were going to have to go to, whether they had to go to sick bay, whether they had to be quarantined, who they were, how long they had to stay on the island before they could be allowed to go out into Manhattan itself. And they were going to be there all day. How cool is that? Now, you open your book and you teach your child about immigration. Who's going to remember more? Who's going to remember more? That is so amazing. That is so amazing. The teachers that are out there that dress up in, you know, our Civil War uniforms and teach kids stuff and get them bang and shooting. We think, oh, that took all day. Child is never going to forget that. Never going to forget that. And so when we do this type of learning, we engulf them. We get them in there. Well, I did a mission trip when I was in high school. We went to Juarez, Mexico. Oh, my word. Has anybody ever been to Juarez, Mexico? It is an armpit. I'm telling you, it was horrible. And so we went to Juarez, and I spoke very little Spanish. I'd taken about 2 years of it in high school. You know, I did what I needed to do to pass the test. I was there for 6 weeks. Guess how good I spoke Spanish when I left? There's something to be said about experiencing the moment and how much we learn when we're part of it and not spectators. And so this type of learning is very powerful. So when you think, oh, not another field trip, you know, we can't be out of the house again. It's Tuesday afternoon, right? They'll know we homeschool. And so we are weird. We swim upstream. That's what we do. So we do field trips, and we go, and we explore. We let them see things and ask questions, and they'll learn. They'll learn. They'll learn so much more than we teach them within four walls. So don't make apologies for taking your kids out and letting them figure things out. I got some great quotes towards the end of this. When we do reading camp, we do all kinds of hands-on stuff. And look, when kids struggle to learn to read, it's because we put them in a chair, we tell them to be quiet, sit down, be quiet. We've got this lesson to do. And for some kids, that's torture. They cannot learn that way. They cannot learn that way. So we let them turn upside down. We let them lay on the ground. We let them, you know, not hurt themselves, but we let them, you know, my son will jump on one of those exercise balls and bounce on it the whole time, and I'm about to lose my mind, but he can tell me everything I've just told him. If I ask him to sit still, he can't do it. He can't do it. There are so many different ways that we can let their little bodies be active while they can pay attention? You know, pre-drill a board and put screws in it and let them screw it in and screw it out, screw it in and screw it out while you read to them, while you give them a history lesson, whatever. Give them Play-Doh and fill a ball of Play-Doh with clothespins and let them pull out the clothespins while you're teaching them a new area of math. I mean, it goes on and on and on because they have to be moving. These kids, it's like nailing Jell-O to a wall. They just cannot be still. And they don't learn when we try to get them to be quiet. Yes, ma'am. Right. She's saying that many times your child can lose focus when they're doing some of those fun things. It's so much more fun than listening to you. She didn't say that. But, I mean, you know, I think that's true of anything. I think that's true of anything. I mean, if we want to read them a lesson and we can't hardly get through a paragraph before they're thinking about Johnny coming over, what are we having for dinner? Hey, Mom, do you remember that movie when he did XYZ? And you're like, are you listening to me? You know, do you even know that I'm talking to you? And so I think that's with anything. The idea here is that there are children that cannot sit and be still and pay attention. Now, some of you may know that your child suffers from ADD or ADHD, which is a real thing, although it is the most overdiagnosed problem in our country. Most of the people I know within homeschool circles aren't interested in a diagnosis. They just want to know, how can I teach this child, right, who's so vastly different from you? Oh, by the way, while maintaining a mother-child relationship that allows you to speak into their life, right, about important things, because they hate you because you're telling them to sit down and be quiet. I think that's real with anything. I think here's what I do, and I don't know that it's the end-all, be-all, but it works when I tutor kids. I will time a child, and I tell parents to do this. When your child is reading, time them. How long can they read before they see something shiny? How long can they read and really understand what they're reading? If they can read for 5, 7, 15 minutes, that's how long our reading time will be. Now, if I want them to read a whole chapter and it's going to take them 30 minutes, then guess what? I'm going to do reading 5 or 6 times that day. But I'm not going to do it for 30 minutes because they're not going to remember what they read. So I may read for 7, 10 minutes, and then I'll watch them do math. And I don't tell them I'm watching them. I just restart a math lesson. How long can they pay attention? How many problems can they do? They can retrieve the knowledge to do that problem, and they can get about 4 or 5 of them done before they want to know what's for dinner. And then you say, okay, they can do 4 or 5 problems. So guess what? Your day, your schedule might look like reading, math, science, reading, math, history, reading, math, outside, reading, math. I mean, you might just do it over and over, but what is your goal? If your goal is to get through the chapter, if your goal is to get through the lesson, then what do you really care if it takes them 5 times to do it? We are homeschooling to be liberated to teach our children the way they learn, not the way it says in the lesson, right? And so when we know better, we do better. So if they can't pay attention while they're doing this little fidgety thing, it's because you've gone too long. So I need to back up. But if they really can't even sit still while you're going through the lesson, then give them something like that to do. And I work a lot with kids on the autism spectrum, and they love that exercise ball. They love that exercise ball. You just get one of those balls and they sit on it instead of a chair. And I'm telling you, you got to pray before you start to teach them, because it will drive you crazy. And they will bounce, and they will bounce, and they will bounce. And autistic kids are amazing. They see the world in a way we don't. They see it 3D, 4D. We see it not that way. They're beautiful, beautiful spirits. They want to learn. And then they'll bounce on that ball, and it drives me crazy. Really, I think I could be committed on times. But look, they bounce, and then you ask them, and they know exactly what you just said. It's fascinating to me. They have to move. They have to do that. That opens the flow of learning for them. They cannot sit still. All right, these are some pictures. This little guy was from a reading camp, but I want to talk to you about Brain Gym momentarily. Now, Brain Gym is the name of a company. I'm not talking about the company. The company was smart because they took the name of what was research done on brain and movement. And so Brain Gym, they figured out that the brain is as active as our physical bodies are. It's always moving. It's always thinking. And I just saw a clip. Has anybody ever seen that? The difference between a man's brain and a woman's brain? And a man thinks in boxes, and he can only open one box at a time. Has to close a box, and the boxes can't touch. But a woman, hers is like a wires, and they're all connected, and everything is connected. So it's like bzz, 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 that's how women are. Well, that's kind of what I'm talking about here with Brain Gym. The brain connects everything, and so it needs movement. It needs to be challenged. It needs to be able to make connections. All of that is happening, and they did this great research that said movement, multi-modalities of teaching help them remember information. That's really great research. Brain Gym, not the company. Now, I get a little bothered, just a little bit, when people try to tell parents that, you know, there's something wrong with your child and you need to go to them to have it fixed. Now, I'm not naive enough to not, I know there are circumstances where that's true, but if I need to balance my child's brain, I can figure out what that means. And what that means is that I'm opening the flow of learning so that they can absorb this new information. And Brain Balance is research that was one of the first people that put out that we need to have movement, multimodality. It's great research. And so if you think about it this way, you and your child are headed down this stream. You're both going to the same destination, right? And so you're going down and you're moving along, and then all of a sudden there's a tree that has fallen in the way of your child's boat, kayak. And you can go, but they have to stop. And so they have to stop. They're caught up. They get out of the water. They pull the kayak up, and they drop it back down on the other side of the tree. You both get to the same place, but it takes them a little bit longer. So what Brain Gym is saying is that all that workout is purposeful. And remember I told you we light up different sides of our brain when that's all research that's been done, and that's that other side of the brain lighting up that's saying, okay, I got to go this way. And so with Brain Balance, so when we move, when we do this multi-sensory teaching, we open that flow of learning. We all get to the same place. It might take your child a little bit longer. Experiments are great. They're great multimodality. Field trips, I just went over that, great multimodality way to teach. Anything. Grow a garden. Plant some seeds. Let's talk about how we create multi-sensory lessons. So you have all this curriculum, right? And so you own it all, some of you. You don't even need to go down to the vendor hall. So how do you take that and make it multi-sensory? So let's throw in some things. Toys and games. You don't need to buy the toys and games. You can create toys and games. Although there's a game for everything. There's a game for everything, but that is multimodality. Seeing it, touching it, hearing it, that's multimodality. So you could create a toy or a game. Activities are different. How many of you remember doing the planets in school where you hung the sun and then the planets from the sun, right? So do we do that in our homeschools? I mean, some of you are creative and you probably do everything that way, right? I'm not. I had all boys. I broke out the crayons. They cried. They didn't want to do anything creative. And so, but I think about those things and how we learned topography by making maps out of paper mache and just all kinds of activities to solidify learning. Activities don't just solidify learning. They actually move things from short-term memory into long-term memory by giving that map back to that learning. And so when we talk about solidifying learning, that's what it means. It's not a post-it note that will blow away tomorrow, unless you're over 40. And that happens all the time. I'm just speaking for myself. Music and rhythm. Now, this is very interesting, music and rhythm. Composers would write music without pianos. They would write music without tunes. They would have it in their head, and they would write this music. And so what they found out was that the music, we're talking about classical music, actually moves to the rhythm of the brain. And so many Montessori-type schools, those types of environments, will play classical music in the background so their children can, it supposedly sets the rhythm of the brain. Now, you can read the same research I do, but on this it's interesting. It's very interesting that rhythm is calming to the brain, so music adds an element. Also, music adds elements to learning things. They have multiplication rap. They have the presidents, the states and capitals. I mean, you can learn anything. Classical conversation people in the room, you can sing them all, can't you? And so that's that whole knowledge that if I just shove in all that information in a way that they can retrieve it, and music is popular. I taught my children the states and their capitals by music. Montgomery, Alabama, Juneau, Alaska, Phoenix, Arizona, Little Rock, Arkansas. Now, my husband used to always say, what's the capital of Wyoming? Because they'd have to sing the whole song. They just learned it. They learned it because they knew he was going to ask. But, I mean, that was a way that we learned it. That was the way that I could learn it. That was the way that I could remember it. And I love that. And so there's lots of things out there written to music. Art and drawing are lost. Lost. They don't even teach them anymore in the public schools. And yet, it opens up a world to some kids. You know, I say there are left-brain people and right-brain people. There are people that draw the world, people that color it. And then you have people that are both. They're enigmas. They're wonderful. They can design a computer program, and they can color your hair 15 shades at the same time. It's beautiful. And so, listen, when we talk about art and drawing, some kids, that's the only way they learn. Now, when I'm teaching comprehension, I specifically will have them draw their understanding of what I've just read. Now, some of your kids hate to draw. But think about the ones that love it. Instead of answering a bunch of questions, just draw that chapter for me. What did you get out of that? You see so much as a parent in what they understand. If it's a spaceship and little green men and you just read, I don't know, because of Winn-Dixie, there's a problem. Because there's no spaceship and little green men in that story. But it tells you so much about what they're understanding. Art and drawing is a way that kids can actually express themselves. And so it's really big. And people who teach this stuff are in a quandary over why it's gotten so forgotten, because it's a great way to teach kids. Back to that paper mache stuff, you can make anything out of paper mache. Has anybody done paper mache? It's messy, but kids remember it. They're touching it, they're feeling it. You can do all kinds of stuff. We did puppets one year for reading camp, and we just did balloons, and we did the paper, and they got to design the characters and that we used, and we just did this little puppet thing. It's messy. And I hate it, but they love it, and they learn, and that's really what it's about. And there's that cooking. Cooking opens up smells and tastes and touch and all that. And think about it. You get them involved in cooking, and they're learning math, and they're learning time, and how to juggle things that they're cooking so they all end at the same time. So much is happening in that. And yet, if you live in the same world I do, there are days when you're just lucky to get something on the table. Never mind have them in there in the way when you're trying to get something done in the kitchen. So, I don't know. That's a different workshop. Acting in skits, that's a lot of fun. We do reader's theater in reading camp, and you think, oh, well, there's just me and my one child. So, be the big bad wolf. You know, act out things, especially when they're little, because they retain so much. They retain so much when you're doing that. And the older they get, we do lots of character comparisons because stories always have a villain, they always have a plot, they always have a climax, all of that's happening. And the more they understand about the characters when they're little, the more they can apply schema to as they read harder books the older they get. And so you do types of reader's theater so they understand the characters. And it's interesting, I do a literature class locally with homeschoolers, and what they all bring to the table is so vastly different. One child's understanding of a character is so different from another child's. And we'll talk about this, and we'll do reader's theater, but they get to see different perspectives, so they understand early on that not everybody is seeing the same thing. And perspective is my favorite word in the English language, because we all have one. And what you think you're hearing me say right now is so different from the person next to you. And this whole weekend will be different. So, I mean, this will be the best thing you've done in a long time. And for some of you, it'll be the worst thing you've done in a long time. Some of you are here with your husbands and wish you weren't. And some of you are here without them and wish they were here. Some of you miss your children, and some of you aren't going home. So perspective, all of that is happening right here in how you understand and what you absorb and what you think about and what you're going to do next. And so all of that is happening when they read and when they understand. So reader's theater is great. And then I have up there videos and television. Again, we can bring up TV programs, anything, PBS, anything that's associated to what we are learning. And then there's the projects and experiments. when you have different properties of chemicals and your liquids weigh different things and all that, you can talk about that all day long. But pour them in a beaker or pour them in a mason jar, whoever you are. Pour them in there and watch them separate and see the lights come on. See the understanding come on. So experiments are big and huge, but they're messy and they take time. But we want to teach them quality. We want to teach them to love to learn and to see those things so that long after you're gone, they'll continue to seek out those things. The biggest thing is to help your child learn how they learn. The biggest gift you can give your child is to help them learn how they learn. But don't cater to it. Now, I have people, I have colleagues, I don't even know if they're speaking about it this weekend, that would love to tell you how to figure out your child's learning style. And I think we all have one, don't get me wrong. But this world is not going to cater to your child's learning style. So if I have a child that struggles auditorily, then I'm going to teach them auditorily because I need to strengthen that. But I'm also going to teach them kinesthetically, visually, tactile, so I can get it in a way that they can learn it while strengthening their area of weakness. Never, ever, ever abandon an area of weakness. Don't abandon it. You got to do it so that they can get stronger in that with which they're weak. I hear this guy's smart. He said that learning is experiencing and everything else is just information. And I liken this to going to a museum. Been to a museum? So you walk through the museum and you see the placards and they'll tell you all about what you're looking at. And we read them to our children. We read them and we look and we ponder, we move on to the next thing. When you walk out of that museum, how much of that do you remember? That's information. That's information. And many, many times when we teach our child from one modality of learning, that's all they got. They have it in the moment and then it's gone. But if they experience it, they put together something, they feel it, they touch it, they hear it, they experience that, then that is real learning. That's when I move it from that short-term memory into the long-term memory. It is not the easiest way to teach. I think that you just have to change your perspective. You are not going to teach them everything. You're just not. There's too much to learn. The world is vast. There's so much that you don't know. You don't even know what you don't know. That's how much there is out there. So we want to teach them to be sponges, to want to learn. It's not easy, but if we change our perspective, am I going to try to teach them everything or am I going to try to teach them well? So in the things that I do get to while they're under my command, they understand. They've got it. They're equipped. They know how they learn. They know how they learn. So beyond me, they can do it. It is the most effective way of teaching. Let me give you a couple of quotes. This was a study done in 2003. It's a little old now. But this was done by R.D. Farkas. And they said that multisensory instructional teaching significantly influenced the academic achievement, and it led to improved attitudes. How many need an improved attitude? I'm talking about you, not your kids, right? And so it led to improved attitudes. Now, I know, oh, Lord, do I know what it's like when you take something out and your kid rolls their eyes or does that whole sigh. You know, you're defeated before you start. And so we change their attitude. Improved attitudes towards learning, increased empathetic response, meaning they're in, they get it, they own it, and then they're in it, the transfer of skills, what they're talking about there is the understanding, the movement from short-term memory to long-term memory, the difference between information and learning. Does that make sense? That was a study done in 2003. Tell me and I forget it. Teach me and I remember. Involve me and I learn. That was Benjamin Franklin. Now, I used to teach at the collegiate level. I used to teach a class about our educational history. We used to teach this way. Back in Benjamin Franklin's time, we used to teach this way. Kids walked around with little globes, and they learned constellations and continents and where things were. They played music for hours, and music is huge when it comes to learning. They would memorize poetry. They would sing. They would do all types of multi-sensory learning, which, guess what? They didn't have all these learning disabilities back then. So whether you have a diagnosed learning challenge or not, this is the best way to teach, period. You may never know that your child has a learning disability if you teach this way, because this is the way we used to teach. And we didn't have the problems that we have with kids learning now. Feel it, see it, hear it, say it. That's types of multimodality learning. Now, Carl Jung is his psychiatrist. One looks back with appreciation to the brilliant teachers, but with gratitude to those who touch their human feelings. The curriculum is so much necessary raw material, but warmth is the vital element for the growing plant and for the soul of the child. Don't plow through the curriculum if you just want to teach your child. That's not how we teach. That's not how they learn. It's not the best way. It's not the best practice. The best teachers are those who show you where to look but don't tell you what to see. I love this, my favorite one, because, again, we all have a different perspective. What you bring to the table is different than what they bring. What they see is different than what you see. Oh, my gosh, you guys, I have 5 minutes, and I have so much more to tell you. This is when I start talking really fast. Oh, wait. Something happened. Okay, now we're at Carl Jung. Let's go back. All right, one of my slides that's going to come up is favorites, because I like to tell you about my favorite multimodality curriculums. Look at what I did. Y'all think I'm a techie person, but I'm not. All right, let's talk about favorites. I'm just going to yell them out, and then I'll ask if you have your favorites. People always ask me. There are lots of multimodality curriculums out there. I am not going to put some of these big guys out of business, but think about some of the curriculums that are in a box. Get grade 4, get grade 5, so on and so forth. Not a lot of hands-on stuff. And they're great because they cater mostly to private schools, but they have a homeschool element. All right, let's talk about reading. I'm going to talk about reading right quick because that's what I do. So it should be no surprise to you that I'm going to tell you about my curriculum. It's called The Struggling Reader. It's all multimodality. You are not drawing a picture, a line, from a sound to a picture that makes that sound. No. When we learn oi, we do oi. When we do ow, we do ow. When we do ooh, we do ooh. And we learn those sounds. And every time they hear when they're being read to, they do that motion. They do it when they read. And guess what? Pretty soon, they don't do the motion anymore, but they do it in their mind. I've made a connection. They know the sound when they see it. O-I, O-W, they all have these different sounds, and they have a motion that goes with it. We do that all during reading camp, too. And so multimodality ways to learn reading. It's called The Struggling Reader, and it's in the vending machine G7. Let's talk about spelling. All about spelling. All about spelling for children like second grade and below. I like it. Lots of white space. They even have it for your technology now. You move the tiles, touching, tactile, kinesthetic. You're moving it. You're building sounds. It's great. Now, I find reading to be very complex. That's what I do. That's my specialty. All about reading is not nearly as multisensory as the all about spelling. All about reading was birthed out of all about spelling, but all about spelling is great with learning to spell. Beyond second grade, I find sequential spelling to be fabulous. It was originally produced by a company called Avco, auditory, visual, kinesthetic, and oral, multisensory. They're not here, but you might find them at Rainbow Resources. Writing. This is not a homeschool curriculum. You'd have to buy it off the internet. It's called the Basic Writing Series. They use a lot of graphics in teaching writing. So before a child even knows what a subject is, they're putting it in an oval. Before they even know what a verb is, they're putting it in a rectangle. And so they have something doing something, somebody doing something. And they do that with graphics until they start adding triangles, which are, they could be any kind of specific thing, like how they jump. It could be a pronoun. It could be an adverb, anything. And they start to put together sentences. And then they use those pictures, and they have them put them together to do sentences, many sentences. Now they're doing paragraphs. It moves through three different binders. It's a great foundational multi-sensory writing curriculum. Now, the basic writing series. Now, I've just met, and she's here, which is very interesting. I met her earlier this year on the homeschool circuit. She is with Here to Help Learning. Now, you might see she's going to speak on writing, and so a lot of it's done on the computer, lots of videos. She put her heart into it. She is on fire. She's like a personality and a half. And so she's here, and that's a writing curriculum that's multi-sensory. History, I think there's nothing better than the mystery of history. It starts at creation. It is very, very Christian deep. So if that's not what you're looking for, that's not what you want. But it's mystery of history starts at creation, moves through the current times, and there's an activity at the end of every lesson for younger students, middle students, and older students. Really, if you do everything in that book, you're learning too much. You're doing too much. Any science curriculum should be hands-on. And if it's not, don't get it. Science is meant to be multisensory. So I don't even have favorites to give you. If you kids, I don't care. Anything that makes you get dirty should work. Okay? All right, let's talk about math. They're here, first time ever. I've been tooting their horn for a couple years now. Schiller Math. She's going to be speaking S-H-I-L-L-E-R. Schiller Math is multisensory, done by a father who said, why can't my kids learn to do math? There are other multisensory math curriculums. I like Schiller Math because it does 3 years. So if you can't learn multiplication, you don't get to stop there. You keep going and doing math that includes multiplication that will help you learn it, but it's a 3-year leveled math. Of course, math, you see, is multisensory. It has some gimmicks to it, but math, you see, is multisensory. Right Start Math is very parent intensive, came right out of Japan where they're very good at math, but it's very parent intensive. If you've got time, it's a great math curriculum. And then finally, teaching textbooks is the answer to a lot of prayers. It's visual, not a lot of tactile, manipulatives you don't touch, but you see them and you hear them, and there's somebody, not a person, but an explanation and drawings for them to see. Does anybody have any they'd like to shout out? Any questions? Because she's going to come up here and body slam me off the stage.
You were saying that there was a writing person here, but I never caught.
The name of her company is Here to Help Learning. Here to Help Learning. Maura, I think, is her name. Does anybody know? It's Here to Help Learning. All right, let me tell you, I'm going to be speaking about the struggling reader. That is going to be tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. If you or someone you know at this convention wants to become a mini reading specialist, that's my intent for tomorrow morning at 11. I will be in booth G7 if you have any questions about any of this. I swear this is my ministry, so if you'd like to come just pass a curriculum by my ears, I can let you know my opinion about it, and that's all I have to offer. But I'm happy to do that. Tomorrow at 4:50, I will be doing a vendor workshop on the struggling reader if you'd like to know more about the curriculum itself. Everything we have here is 25% off. If you come to that workshop, it's an additional 10% off here at the conference. I do that because I want you to understand how to teach reading from a multisensory way. All right, you guys are just getting started, so hang in there. Thanks for coming to me the first go around.